Well, good evening. It's just real good to see each of you tonight, and I was glad to see so many here even this morning in our 10 o'clock studies, and I have been very, very well fed since I have been here, and I think it's just more fun to eat in cold weather. But I have thoroughly enjoyed the spiritual interaction that we've had, the kind of encouragement and prodding that we need to go on our very serious yet joyful endeavor to be with God throughout eternity. And we're hoping that if you are visiting in the audience tonight, and maybe for the very first time, that you'll feel comfortable and that we will not look down on you, because we know you, and we know you so well that we just cherish this moment and opportunity for you to at least have your appetite wet tonight, hopefully for further studies and hopefully to endear yourself to the very heart of God. We're a people that do not claim we are sinless, but we do know ourselves, as God tells us about ourselves, as well as our own explorations, that we know what we need, that there is no other way but Jesus Christ. We need Him. And that's the only way to God, to stand before a holy God who cannot accept sin. We're just so glad for your presence tonight, and we just want to continue the thoughts that were already given to us in prayer and in song tonight. Scientist Albert Einstein once wrote, "The fairest thing that we can experience is the mysterious. He who knows it not can no longer wonder, can no longer feel with amazement, is as good as dead, a snuffed out candle." Now, if what he said was true, then there are millions and millions of people who are snuffed out candles. I think one of the things we enjoy about children as we observe them is that freshness, that excitement, that thrill, that wonder. We love for them as they taste new things and they experience new things. Their eyes pop wide open at birthday time, and they rip open those presents. And sometimes we buy a lot of them just so they'll do that. We just love to see the bright eyes and the excitement and the zeal and the smile on their face. We buy $1,200 cameras and movie cameras, hundreds of dollars on 35 millimeter cameras, so we can try to capture that wonder and that excitement that a child can reflect. But like so many, they grow up and they often lose that excitement and that sense of wonder, and they start getting bored with life as they fill their mind with scientific facts and formulas that were given to them in such a boring sort of way, a dry sort of way, detached from any being, from any person, from any life. Just scientific formulas are just going to change next year. Even though there are some creationist scientists, I think you know what I mean. That for most, it's just a kind of fantasy, that an artificial wonder that you go through. And then you just become like everybody else, lost in the crowd and very isolated from human involvement. The loss of wonder, the loss of excitement, is costly. If you've lost your spark for God tonight and the thrill of Bible study and just learning about God and thinking about God, then your other option is arrogancy, thinking you can explain everything. It's an intelligentsia that believes that they just have arrived because of the knowledge that they have. They stuff themselves with it, become very cold people. And you become, when you lose your wonder and excitement, very, very hollow and very shallow. Do you know what shallow, hollow worship is? Some of us have tasted it. It's when we lose our sense of wonder and excitement. Have you lost yours? And when you lose your wonder and excitement, you don't worship God in spirit and in truth. Spirit's gone. Truth, maybe. Some people, all they've got is truth. And isn't it sad that some people just have spirit but no truth, and some people don't have any of the above? Now, who's better off? Well, I think people with truth are better off. Then somebody else would say, I think people with spirit are better off. I think God's got it right, spirit and in truth. And when you lose your sense of wonder, you lose the depth of your worship. And I'll tell you what else happens, because what gives fuel to the fire of service is worship. You don't really serve like you want to. It's kind of out of, well, I guess I'll put my name on the hospitality list. I sure never served an Akatura before. I don't know what that is. You serve because you worship. Worship should be a place where you fill your bucket, and with that bucket being full, you expend yourself and you come back and fill it up again. And if you don't have the wonder, it's all dull and dry and a formula, if there ever was one. God never intended for it to be that way. Our society, we want entertainment. We don't want enrichment. We want a good time, not a good quality life. Tonight I'd like for us to turn and look at the wonder chapter in the Bible, Psalm 139. The theme, the wonder of God. The wonder of God. You see here it's got 24 verses, and this is neatly divided up into four sections, 6 verses each. So it's very easy to outline. There are 4 wonders of God as I see them here that can add excitement, which will help you in your worship, which will then help you in your service, and your whole life can be enhanced and closer to God when you focus on God. Because you see what happened to Job? He did not get an answer as to why he was suffering, but what did God do with him? He said, if you want to get over the hump of your anxieties and your problems and your turmoil and your anguish, start focusing in on me. Get your mind on me. Where were you when I created the world? Where were you? See, that's what he does. And if you want to rise above circumstances in your life and you want to get over that divorce that you're in that you just couldn't help, and you've got bad problems because your child died, and these are real problems that people have, or you're living with a man you never thought would become an alcoholic, and you have things inside you that really bother you about yourself, and you can't seem to be stable and consistent, he says, focus in on me. And that's what Psalm 139 will help us to do tonight. You see what happened to Moses? You know, we'll read that and it says, Why did God have him take the rod and throw it down and become a snake? And he says, pick it up by the tail again. Well, this is just a test. It's almost like he's up there, this is just a test. Come on, why? He gave all these excuses, didn't he? And rather than saying, you shouldn't do all that, he didn't do that. He said, you focus on me, and you will when you start having to pick up a snake. You get your mind off your excuses and your self-pity, and you get it on him, you'll be right. That's what he's doing in Psalm 139. And you know when it says that he's a man after God's own heart, David? That's why he reflected and meditated on God. God was big to David, not small. Our God becomes small when we do like the Israelites did. They focus on the locusts. We're like grasshoppers. See, God became the grasshopper. God became small. We want to keep him big tonight and forevermore. And so we find the wonders of God here. There are also questions in each of these, 4 questions we can ask tonight, as well as 4 problems of humanity that we can overcome because of God. First 6 verses, the wonder of God's knowledge. The question, how well does God know me? Oh, very well. And the problem that it seems to answer is the problem of humanity, the identity crisis. The identity crisis, I think, has been risen to magnitude proportions because of the population explosion. Now, Peyton City might have trouble understanding a population explosion. And that's why your world of technology just zooms you in on the problem, where you can go to L.A. and 1 million people equals 0. Figure that one out. Very cold, No interaction with people. You just walk on by and you just pass thousands of people. No relationship with any of them. Some people from foreign countries can't figure us out. Why we don't talk. Why we don't interact. Why we're not friendly. Why we're just there to get our presents at the store or get our groceries at the store and just hurry out that door. We have stunned the world in that regard. And here in verses 1 through 6, our significance is enhanced. When you think of yourself as just the earth is a little dot in this network of galaxies, it helps us to read passages like this one, because Psalm 139 is linking us to God and removes the fear of just being a number, you know, 317-02-5267, you know, a social security number. That's all a number. Don't you get nauseated of that? There are people who lose their identity and sense of humanity because of that. Psalm 139 just says, I am omniscient. And that means that God knows everything. That's heavy. And he says that God knew him five times in this chapter. God knew me. Now that personalizes truth. He sees under the mask, the skating rink. It's not surface stuff with him. It's beneath the surface. God knew him. And it says, why? O Lord, thou hast searched me. During the Dobie Gillis era, the Maynard G. Kreb, the Beatniks, it was, you dig, everything, you dig, you know, and we say, you know, you dig. He's saying, you dig me, Lord, you dig me, you search me, you explore me, you know me, you go beneath the surface in my life. One thing that I got to thinking about, you know, how could he know me? He would have to know himself. He'd have to know himself in order to know me. How would he distinguish between that which is worthy and unworthy? Unless he knew his own power, how could he have created all things? Unless he knew of his own wisdom, how could he declare this the beauty of his works? Unless he knew of his own glory, how could he know the end of his works? And unless he knew his own holiness, how could he know evil? He couldn't. Unless he knew of his own justice, how could there be a judgment day? How could he punish anybody unless he knew himself so well? See, his understanding, yeah, like we say, yeah, I understand that. That's a faculty you have. But with God, it's not like that. It's a very simplistic nature, not simple-mindedness, a simplistic nature, to where God does not understand by a faculty of himself. He is understanding. He is all knowledge. Now, that's hard to think about when you're limited. But that's what he's declaring to us here. And so we look, and it says that God knows everything, and that it just invokes adoration here. We're not dealing with a pretended God. He is searching. And by the way, this searching is not something that, you know, sometimes searching means, well, I've got to find it. It implies that there is some ignorance on my part and it's removed when I finally observe it. No, that's not what he's dealing with here. When he searches, he's not going exploring from the standpoint that he is ignorant. He is already there knowing, okay? What does God know about you? You ever try to hide things? I guess all of us have tried to hide things from some people, while other people we might trust with everything until they blow it and go tell everything we told, and then we don't trust anybody and don't talk to anybody and don't have any friends. But God, he knows what we do. That's what he's saying here. See, he goes from the general in verse 1, now the specific. Thou knowest my downsetting, mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. See, you know what I do. Common, casual moments, whether I'm resting, my self-renunciation, my pride, you know all of this. You understand my thought afar off. You don't miss anything about me. Afar off. You know my thoughts afar off. You ever been in a conversation with someone and you're on a certain wavelength, and then a flash of thought comes in unrelated to that conversation? It's just in there. God knows at the beginning of that flash of thought, he's already there with you. That is incredible. He knows us. what we do, what we think. He knows what we think. God knows. Between the ears and the mouth, He's there. He knows. Right now, you mean He knows what I'm thinking? That's right. He knows what you're thinking right now. Third thing He's looking at here in verse 3, Thou compassest my path and my lying down and aren't acquainted with all of my ways. Compasseth, that's the idea of searching, to sift, to winnow is grain. He knows the filtered result. He passes judgment on our action. My path, my palate, my resting, my running. He's saying, you surround me as air surrounds creatures. I'm encircled by the bounds of your knowledge. Walking or sleeping, you're there. That, you know, that ought to fill us with awe. And you remember last night, the key to morality and wisdom, which is going to help in those moral decisions and regulate it? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of that wisdom. This is what we mean here by the fear of the Lord, this awe, this respect. But we don't need fear, we need courage. And we have Him who knows us and will provide and help us. So it's with delight. We don't mourn here. We delight in God. Look at verse 4. He says, For there is not a word in my tongue. Oh, your Lord, Thou knowest it altogether. He knows the motives even behind the words. And one thing about this I think is beautiful is, nobody can bring false testimony to God about you. Doesn't that refresh you? That helps me to know that, because He already knows what I am thinking. And you know, God doesn't just say, you know, with us, if we're not learning, we get bored. With God, He never learns. God never learns. He doesn't go to school. And there's not ever a time with God that He'd say, I didn't know that. Or, oh, that surprised me about Him. He knows us that well. What we do, what we think, where we go, what we say, He even knows what I need. He knows what I need. His guiding, restraining hand is upon us. Notice that word beset. Verse 5, Thou hast beset me behind and before and laid Thy hand upon me. Beset, that means hemmed in. It's almost like you've got a prison guard and he's watching over me, every move that I make. And yet at the same time, he has promised not to be some kind of warden over me, but a protector and a guide. In Isaiah 49, verses 15 and 16, a great tender expression, I think, captures the whole idea here of God. Can a woman forget her sucking child? No. She should not have compassion on the son of her womb. God cares. He has compassion. He made us. Yea, they may forget, yet will I not forget thee. Behold, I have graven thee upon my palms of my hands. Thy walls are continually before me. Look at verse 6. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. What is he doing? What is he doing right there when it says such knowledge is too wonderful? It's high. I cannot attain it. He's saying that our life is before our God. It's in His hands, and I cannot even grasp it. See, our minds are finite, not infinite, and as a result, there's no line to really measure the infinite. So out goes the identity crisis. How well does He know me? Oh, very well. Here's the wonder of His knowledge. But now, verses 7 through 12, here's the wonder of His presence. All right, here's a question for you. How close is God to me? One of the great problems of humanity is loneliness. You mean there can be a person at a WVU game, the last home game of the season, and somebody in that crowd could be lonely? Oh, not just one. Indeed, lonely. An atheist wrote on a chalkboard in a class, God is nowhere. He left the room for a minute. Christian walked up to the board without the teacher being there. He changes all it takes. And that's what this is saying. God is now here. We call that omnipresent. He is everywhere. David felt free to travel. And by the way, a Hebrew is not a seafaring person. And they don't just say, hey, let's go to the Mediterranean Sea and take off. They don't do that. They were afraid of the sea. And yet he said, I can go anywhere and you are there. And the only way I can escape you is by your own power and choice. There is no way. And he gives all these figures here in verses 7 through 12 to illustrate that. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither? See the two withers? Two withers there? It's like an echo. No answer comes back to him. Makes it dreadful work to sin because he already knows what you're doing. Jonah in the cabin? Oh, yeah, he saw him. He was there with Jonah in the cabin. Adam in the thickets? Oh, yeah, he was there in the thickets. Jeremiah 23 and verse 24 declares, do I not fill the heavens and the earth, declares the Lord? Yes, he does. The answer is, yes, he does. So we commit acts of treason at the very foot of his throne. You know, when you're aware of God, that's mighty hard sin, isn't it? Now, he's there. And so verse 8 goes on, if I ascend up into the heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in hell. Now, you expect to see him in heaven, but the realm of the unseen, I wouldn't expect. He's there. He is there. Behold, thou art there. You see, behold, more wonder to meet God in Sheol than in heaven. And look at the expression in verse 9. I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost part of the sea. Wow. What expressions. Russian cosmonauts, when they were orbiting, I didn't find your God up here. Heard one preacher on the radio say, I wish he'd step out of his capsule, then he'd find God. He's everywhere. He was in the capsule. Verse 10, even there shall thy hand lead me and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. When do people usually steal and rob and do dastardly deeds of wickedness? Night. Nighttime. What's he saying here? He's saying, that's a joke to God. I mean, it's got to be terrible but humorous to him that these little humans are doing things at night as if he couldn't see it. He created light. He is the God of darkness, and darkness is not darkness to him. He sees right through. It's like x-ray vision. So here these people are sneaking behind walls. It's about as obvious to him as you ever play hide and go seek with a two-year-old. So here's a two-year-old going to hide behind this piece of wood. Here's the way they do. I guess they're afraid to just be totally isolated and secluded. And they always have half of their cells out and half their cells in. God is everywhere. He sees everything that we're doing. It is very humbling to know that. And there is no escaping him. And there are those who tried it. And so verse 11. Surely the darkness shall cover me. Even the night shall be light about me. Don't take license from the dark. And isn't it silly sometimes? I guess most of us have done it. If we're brave enough to go down the hall by ourselves, so the boogeyman won't get us, we jump under the covers. Man-made covers. Now, what are those covers going to do when the boogeyman really wants to get you? Them covers aren't going to do you a bit of good. And besides that, in the summer we do that, and it's so hot under there. And that's what he's saying here. So don't look, these things are man-made. You cannot escape me. I made all of these things. Why don't you just take it in a positive way and understand that I'm with you always, even unto the end of the world, that you're never alone with me, that I'm near, that I care, that I can help, that I can embrace, that I can love you, and I can accept you. And so, we find that we can learn so much, but there are some people who do not learn. Thoreau, I think, had it right when he said that the mass of men live their lives in quiet desperation, and I think that's right. O.J. Simpson. You'd think, well, there's a guy who has it all. He's a good family, a lot of money. Now, He wrote an article in Life magazine. He says, there's something missing out of my life. I don't know what it is. Jerry Lewis lives with a motto. He said, there are three things that are real. God, human folly, and laughter. Since you can't do anything with the first two, see what you can do with the third, laughter. That's why he's a comedian. That's all I had to do. I mean, that is sad. That is desperate. That is loneliness. No identity. Lonely. It's the way people have chosen to live their lives. And the third problem is the self-image. And the third solution, he says, I am the God of all power. You know, I know everything. I am everywhere in my presence and now in my power. And the question, how carefully has God made me? Self-esteem, self-image problems? Oh, they're gone. They're gone. As you look at this in verse 13, for thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. What he's dealing with in this section here, he could have gone with the power of creation, but he didn't. He focused in on something else, the miracle of birth. And isn't it? No, it's a wonder, not a miracle. Is it a miracle? Well, how about Adam, fully grown? Ah, yes. But it's just a common through natural means. Is that really a miracle? No, but we use that term sometimes. But it's not really a miracle, but it is a wonder. And we should never lose our thrill at that. He deals with birth, conception, development, perpetual wonders here. Genetics, anatomy, obstetrics. They can't erase anything in this passage. Nothing. And I think it is tragic that the human fetus has looked upon by so many in society as often just considered a nuisance to be removed, just like an appendix operation. Oh, there's a baby. You don't want it? Get it out. When you read this, you just can't do that. Just cannot do that. You admire it. You welcome it. David, when he was out there in the fields as a shepherd or running from Saul, he thought about this. What did he think about? You possessed my reins. Now, this section, this is amazing. It's written before biological science on this subject. Before all the evidence that we have and the knowledge we have on the prenatal state, the unborn embryo, the fetus. Before the technical obstetricians came in and told us and taught us so much. 9-month pregnancies has always been a mystery, especially now in this era. When this was written, it certainly was. In Ecclesiastes chapter 11 and verse 5, neither do you know how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child. But those are the areas we've got to be experts on. You know, somebody is with child and we've got to tell them, well, I think it's a boy or I think it's a girl or I think it's going to be born early. No, it's going to be born late. I can tell. We're all authorities on things we don't know a thing about. God even said it. We're not authorities on this, but God is. He is all powerful and he created this and it's amazing. Look at the word here. Verse 13, for thou. That's very emphatic. The language in the Hebrew, very emphatic. What he's saying here is, you yourself alone, Lord, you only. Do you know this? Did you form this? Did you originate this? See, conception is often looked upon as an accident. Why us? It's a blessing. It's a blessing. So he formed my inward parts. What does that mean? My reins. Well, that's the kidneys. All the internal organs that are so necessary to our life. I knew you, I formed you, just a little speck. How big of a speck? No bigger than a period at the end of a sentence. And yet it's a thicket. Look at the language he uses here. It's like a thick network, a weaving, a knitting together. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. That's pause. You see what he's doing? He's pausing for Thanksgiving. That's called spontaneity. Doesn't it mean, you know, you want to read your Bible at 9 o'clock, you've got to praise God. No, it just came as a result of what was in his heart. He is amazed at the creation of God. And we ought to get back to that spark and that wonder tonight as we think about this weaving, this protecting in the mother's womb on his part. This thanksgiving is so spontaneous, so beautiful. Next time you watch somebody in gymnastics, or if you as a young person go to gymnastics class, Let your parents or let yourself think about not just gymnastics. You think about God made the body that as you develop your muscles that you can be that coordinated. That's His handiwork. He gave you the tools and then you exercise it. But don't just watch the Olympic Games and some Olympic Games just, well, I just watch the game. Think about the God who made that beautiful artistic body that is doing these marvelous things. And think about all the movements that are going on, all the muscles that are working. It is amazing. And so Henry Morris said, the information stored in its DNA has been transmitted generation after generation through the ancestral family line from Noah and ultimately from Adam and Eve. At the time of David's writing, all of his own ancestors had already departed in the spirit to those lower parts of the earth, but their genetic inheritance continued to influence the development of their yet unborn descendants on the earth. He was a child of promise, right? And he reflected on this from a genetic point of view. He found traits in him that were traits of those who kept handing it generation after generation, traits of leadership qualities and of God. Today, your heart will beat 103,000 times. Your blood will travel 168,000 miles. No wonder you're tired at the end of the day, huh? You're going to breathe some 23,000 times and inhale 438 cubic feet of air and speak, I'm probably the exception today, you're going to speak on the average of 36,000 words. And you're going to move 750 major muscles and use, I know some of us, we can't admit because we just don't think we have that many brain cells, but you actually use 7 million brain cells today. And you, it's like, and one heart doctor was explaining, of course I had to ask somebody else what he said, but what the man said he said was that there is a kind of electricity inside your heart, a spark there that gives life and it pumps, and it's all automatic. In other words, isn't it great that you don't have to say, heart, thump, thump, heart, thump? You don't have to do that. You know, what do you say to your diaphragm? You don't have to do that. It's all automatic. It's taken care for us. And that is by His own provision. So verse 15 says, my substance was not hid from thee when... It's like an artist, okay? It's like an artist. And he hides it in the making and it needs to be hid. And it's almost like he takes it off when it's all finished. Here it is. Da-da-da-da. He's showing us what he has made. I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lower parts of the earth. He slips into those early hours of conception, looking at the frame, the bony substance, the skeleton. Look at the secret. He says, in secret, not shameful, not concealed, the lowest parts of the earth, safety, protected, hiding. There's value in that. You're curiously or skillfully wrought. You know what that means? Variegated, various. That's the same word used in the book of Exodus with the curtain, you know, that separated the most holy place from the holy place. That's the curtain, the embroidery work that the ladies made. The curtain they made, same terminology there. But what tapestry can compare with the human fabric, the veins, the sinews, the muscles, the nerves? If He can do all that, can't He perfect you? See, self-image? Wow. Look at verse 16, if you will. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and thy book, aha, that's really got a lot of things started, and thy book, all thy members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was none. God does not lock you in to where you have no will. Some people can get that out of reading this, and that's a tragedy. I want to read to you what Kyle and Daly said in the commentary, which I think is quite astute on their part. He said, among the days which were performed in the idea of God, there was also one, says the poet, for the embryonic beginning of my life, the divine knowledge embraces the beginning, the development, and the completion of all things. That's really all he's saying. Don't read into it anymore. Otherwise, you're going to be looking and preaching an irresistible grace just from a passage like this. He says, the knowledge of the thoughts of God, which are written in the book of creation and the revelation, is the poet's cherished possession to ponder. And it's his favorite pastime and pursuit. What was David's favorite pastime or pursuit? Thinking and broadening his mind about God's creative activity and planning. He falls asleep pondering. He wakes up pondering this. Do you think a lot about the creative activity and works of God? That's a healthy spiritual action on our part. So one conclusion you can make on this section when you look at his power is, you know, the little sign when you walk in some of those GM products, you walk in the car on the, after you pull the door, you look at that little frame, it says, body by Fisher. What he's saying is here, body by God. It's got his stamp, his image upon it. So when you talk about abortion, when you talk about suicide, when you talk about euthanasia, mercy killings, we have no right, David is saying in effect, to interfere or play God. We have no right to prescribe death, but to respect it. Test tube babies. Ah, what about the test tube babies? They're getting close to creating life. Oh, but they've also learned that even when they do it, it still takes life to make life. So they haven't taken away a thing. Last of all, look at verses 19 to 24, particularly verse 23, when he is talking here about judgment. The wonder of his judgment. The question, how much will God protect me? And what it solves, the dilemma of humanity? It answers the problem of worry and fear. Anybody here guilty of that? Hands down, nobody. But you might meet somebody who does have a problem with that. So if you'll look, he talks about the enemies, that God will take care of the enemies. That's a comfort. That's a comfort. There are some people I would love to expose that I can't. Can't get any evidence to expose them for what they are. God will take care of them. Verse 23, search me. I think this is deeper than in verse 1, search. I really do. I think this is deeper here. I think he's dealing about a yearning to be so devout that he's wanting to be so pure that he says, God, I'm not saying I can stand your analysis, but I am saying I want to know what's wrong with me. I want to be more like you. Do you have that attitude tonight? I thought about that. Do I really have that attitude? I mean, look at this verse. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me. Put me to the test to reveal what I'm really like. Do it. Did you ever pray for humility? And the day didn't even close. And you got that confrontation or that call? You got humbled real fast? Kind of makes you not want to pray for humility, doesn't it? It really does. Just as soon as I pray for humility, why, I even get a call before the day's over and somebody's blaming me for something and reaming me out for something I don't even know about. But that's what he's saying here. It is a beautiful attitude, a longing for the searching eye of God. In verse 23, he's got a very lowly acknowledgement, not to stand investigation, but the joy of, hey, I've got a very confident love in you. Peter said, Lord, you know all things. And he's saying, all right, tell me what I need. Any hidden areas of my life, reveal them to me. How many Christians you know really feel that way? Do you really know of a Christian? Can you name even one? Two, how about five? Can you name five Christians who would actually come up to you or the elders or anybody else and say, do I have any faults that do you think I really need to work on? I know hundreds. I know hundreds. But up against those hundreds, I also am aware of thousands who won't even let us do more than just say, hi, how are you? I'm fine. Bye. That's it. That's the only relationship I've had with some brethren who are saying that they'll die for me. I'd like to know a little more about them before they go dying for me. And I would think they want to know a little bit about me, more about me before they go dying for me, don't you think? Here is a longing for the searching eye of God. Here in verse 23 is a longing for the testing of the thoughts. Try me. The result of the investigation. You'll know my heart and you'll know my thought. Here's a longing to cast out evil in his life. Wicked. Look at this. He says, and see if there be any wicked way in me. Check me out. Put me to the test. Wow. You know what that means? Forced labor. The word wicked means forced labor. You see what he's imagining in our minds? Sin is slavery. That's what he's saying. Sin leads to bitterness. And another thing I think he's saying here is a petition for the guidance of the everlasting hand and way of God. Are you ready to do that tonight and become a Christian? If you pick up your hymn book, we're ready to sing and encourage and invite you on behalf of Jesus Christ to believe in Him and to repent of your sins and to be buried with Him in baptism tonight. To be added to Him, not to sit in a pew and die, but to be alive with wonder, filling with worship, and go out and serve and have the attitude knowing God is a God of justice, but He's your judge. God, any fault I have, let me know what it is. And you know how you do that? Start asking some people, what do you think of me? Have you ever gotten a discussion with Christians like that? I tell you, it'll silence a preacher real quick. That's hard to do. It really gets you thinking. And don't you think we need that? And don't you think you need to respond to the gospel tonight? Well, here's an opportunity to say yes. As we wonder at the magnificence of our God, we humbly serve Him and hopefully humbly obey Him now as together we stand and sing.